fairly large church, and he heard that one of the parents in the congregation had lost their child that last week. This dad was an occasional churchgoer, only came out once a month, so he gave him a call rather than visiting him. And as he was there on the phone, he just kind of tried to be present. There's not much you can say to comfort someone, as a bit like the situation we were hearing about earlier with Brenda. And as he listened, the situation actually turned out worse. The father was really tragically involved in the accident that caused their child's death. And it was just terrible. And he's sitting like on the phone just going, what do I say? How do I help this guy? And then the father says something quite astonishing. He said something like this: I feel I've reached this point in my life where I had absolutely nothing left. And it turns out for the first time in my life, Jesus has become real to me. Is that unusual? Is that strange? And so Carl's like, no, that's not normal. Perfectly normal. Yes, it's fine. And as he gets off the phone, he's like, wow, what's this about? And so because he's a cool American pastor, he goes on Facebook and he writes the following statement. Complete the following phrase. Jesus became real to me when... ... and asks his friends to comment on it. And within a few hours, he gets hundreds of replies. Some of them were general, like this. Jesus became real to me when I could no longer pretend I was in control. When I had to admit I couldn't fix things. When I had nobody else to turn to. Or when I disappointed everyone who loved me. But actually, a number of people put some very specific things there. I was told, Jesus became real to me when I was told I had 3 months to live because of stage 4 cancer. When my depression became too much for me to bear. When I finally admitted I wasn't strong enough to save my marriage or end my addiction to looking at certain online images. When my wife was killed in a car accident. And then there was one answer that seemed to sum up almost everybody else's answer, and it was this. Jesus became real to me when I came to the end of me. When they were really broken, Jesus came real to them. As I wrestled with this story, so much surprised me. And if it surprised you in any way at all, then I think the passage this morning has a lot to say to you. We're looking at Luke 7. From verse 36 to 50. So with that introduction, I'd like Emma to come up and just read the passage for us. Luke 7.
Now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she bought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 5 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Now which of them will love him more?" Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled." "You have judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned towards the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has forgiven little loves little." Then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." The other guests began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace."
Thank you. This story comes up in each of the four Gospels. It seems it's probably two different occasions. This one here in Luke, which happens first, and then another occasion, which happens later in Jesus' life in the other Gospels. If it seems strange to you that this is repeated, that it happens more than once, it shouldn't be too surprising. Apparently pouring oil on somebody's head or expensive oil on their body was a renowned way of recognizing someone's greatness. So I was looking, this has been immortalized in Greek and Roman mythology. So even Pliny in the first century writes about this as an honor. So this was not as strange to them as it is perhaps to us to hear about. And then secondly, the fact it happens at dinner. I was thinking about this. If you wanted to catch Jesus at some point in the day, in the afternoon he's often teaching, moving around, and he's got large groups surrounding him. Whereas in the evening, you might catch him in a smaller group when he's not teaching and doing business. It's probably the best time to try to catch him, which is when this woman tries to get him. Another brief aside before I dive into the passage. This is a bit of a theology aside for you. I'm going to refer lots to brokenness as the term I use in this passage instead of sinfulness. The Bible in this passage talks a lot about sinfulness, and it's really interesting that we're studying sin this evening, because I think sin is a far broader category than just brokenness. Brokenness can be part of it, but sin is so much bigger. It includes willful perversion of God's commands. It's very definitely against God. Brokenness is sometimes vague, but also it includes the good we don't do and the bad we do do. Whereas brokenness, as we're going to look at it in this passage, is just a very small subset of sin. But because it's kind of the aspect this passage looks at, I want to use that term to help you narrow in on that issue. Okay, theology aside over, we're going to dive in and look at this story, initially through the eyes of the woman. She's described in verse 37 as one who's lived a sinful life. That's probably a euphemism for lady of the night or one who serviced men. So she's a social outcast. And yet something's stirring within her to want to come to Jesus. She clearly is not lacking loads of money. She's got an alabaster jar of perfume that in one of the Gospels they reckon that cost lots. It certainly did if it was full, about a year's wages. So she's not really short of money. She's done well with her business, but yet she's not satisfied. Something's stirring. So she finds out where Jesus is and she comes to the house. And I think at this point, what happens next is not planned. She's got her jar of perfume. That's the plan. And then she finds the house and she enters the room. And at that point, I imagine it goes silent. Eyes are on her. The glances, the stares. And I think at that point she begins to cry. And perhaps just a little bit, as she begins to come back, oh no, everyone's looking at me. And I know that I shouldn't be here. I come into this house. I don't have permission to be in this house. I'm going to be in so much trouble. I'm already an outcast. Now I've broken in. What are they going to do to me? But she's not crying excessively because she can see enough to find where Jesus is. So initially she's just crying a bit, but then she finds Jesus. And then I think she hits that point, that threshold of crying. I don't know if you've experienced this where you're crying a little bit and you're trying to hold it back. You're managing a bit and then you go over and it's just tears galore, okay? She hits that point, the uncontrolled, unrestrained crying. How do I know that? Because she's got enough tears to wipe Jesus' feet. You do not produce enough tears through gentle sobbing. She has finally gone over and really gone crying. And I don't think she was like that at the start, because if she was, she wouldn't have been able to see where Jesus is. When you're crying that badly, you just can't see. She's gone over that. And she's at Jesus' feet. Augustine says at this point, I love this commentary on these verses, she shed tears, the heart's blood. Isn't that lovely? So her plan's in pieces, but she's at Jesus' feet. And I think she improvises there. She's wetting his feet with her hair, with her tears, and then she's not going to ask Simon for a towel. He's hardly likely to want to give her a towel. So she unties her hair and dries his feet, and finally she gets around to pouring the perfume on. And I wonder if she's kind of noticing, despite all her crying, that actually they haven't removed her yet. She's probably expecting a hand on her shoulders and casting her out, and the insults haven't started. And then Jesus speaks. I bet she would have loved to have looked at him, but she probably wouldn't have dared for her sense of shame. And she wouldn't have been able to for all her tears anyway, to actually look at Jesus. And interestingly, Jesus speaks, but to somebody else. So all of a sudden, all this attention that was on her, all the doubts she had of to whether this would be accepted, suddenly Jesus is engaging with somebody else. And it's like, oh, what's happening? And he recounts verse 41 to 43. Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Which of them will love him more? And Simon says, the one who had the bigger debt cancelled. And Jesus says, you judge correctly. She may have been able to understand that story. She may have been crying so much. She might not have been able to. But even if you understand it, what does this mean? Okay, it's obvious. Who owes more money and is forgiven is forgiven. What difference does that make? And then she gets it in verse 44, because Jesus starts talking. Simon, you didn't do this, but she did. You didn't do this in verse 45, but she did. You didn't do this, verse 46, but she did. He's not condemning her. Every other Jew in that room wouldn't want to have anything to do with her. Every other teacher would condemn her as unworthy and unfit to be a follower of God. And it's worth abstracting at this point. Actually, every other religion would condemn her as being unworthy to follow God. She would need to go away and do loads of good deeds. She needs to balance out. It's her bad karma that's brought her the situation she's in. She needs to sort that out. That's not what Jesus does. Verse 47. I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who's been forgiven little loves little. And so you go, oh, so was it her love that she showed that caused her forgiveness? Well, no. That's why Jesus taught the parable in verse 41 to 43. Both of them owed lots of money. They were forgiven, and therefore they loved much. Jesus is going, you see this woman? She owed loads, but she's been forgiven. Therefore she loved much. You know, it's not because Jesus doesn't realise her sinful life. The word sins comes up three times in verse 47 to 49. The word sinner comes up three times in this passage, referring to her. Jesus is aware of how she's lived. But that's not how it works in Christianity. That's not how grace works. The message of Christianity is Jesus lived that perfect life, the good life that we couldn't. And then he made that swap for us, taking our punishment, if you like, what we deserved, and giving us what he deserved, heaven. It's very countercultural. I think in life, so often, we're so used to having to justify what we do. You send off application forms for work to try and get people to give you grants, or I'm filling out an ethics form this week trying to keep them happy, and it's a bit of a game because they agree with what I'm doing, otherwise they wouldn't let me do it, but you have to fill out the form and do everything right. Or, you know, you send off a CV and you have to kind of sell yourself. And we get into this mentality almost as if that's what we need to do with God. But if he sees everything, why is it about us doing a sales pitch? And then in a relationship, you would never treat someone that way. You wouldn't say to your wife or girlfriend or boyfriend or husband, look, if you make me 1,000 good recipes, then I might love you. You know, at that point, you wouldn't have a relationship like that. You love someone and it leads you to doing that, but you don't base it on works. And so why do we apply that logic to God? It took me ages when I was first investigating Christianity because I saw other Christians and I saw that they were good and I wanted to be like that and I was trying and trying and I couldn't. I was struggling. I couldn't do it. Then I realized this point that actually it's not about being good enough. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Jesus wants us broken, and it's like the story at the start. That's when we really see and recognize who Jesus is, when we recognize our brokenness. You cannot be too broken to come to Jesus. I want to go through the story again, and this time walk through it through the eyes or looking at Simon. Because in many ways, this is an interesting story, looking at it also through his eyes. So let's go through it with him. With him initially, things seem quite good. He's invited Jesus to dinner, so it doesn't say that it's a test. It could be a genuine interest. It's quite early in Jesus' career or his ministry, if you like. So he could just be interested in finding out more about him. However, he fails a bit at hospitality 101. Verses 44 to 46, Jesus lines out his errors. 44, he doesn't get into foot washing. Given that roads are dusty there and shoes aren't very advanced, your feet are going to be not a very pretty state. And so when you arrived, it was customary either for the host to wash them or to provide a servant who would wash them, or at the very least, just to provide a bowl of water. Simon clearly fails on all of that. At verse 45, he fails on greeting Jesus with a kiss. Often you give a kiss on the hand. So he doesn't do very well there. And then verse 46, he doesn't put any oil on Jesus' head. This did quite puzzle me as I was researching it. I don't know why anyone would want oil poured on their head. I mean, if you would, let me know. And next time I see you, I'll make sure I bring some oil and just sprinkle it on. Apparently, in those days, given that the hot sun was beating down your head, a bit of oil created some relief. That's the reason behind it, apparently. So Simon doesn't show this to Jesus. We don't know if he did greet the other guests well, or whether he just missed out on greeting everyone this way. It's not clear. Either way, he fails to greet Jesus, but then this woman comes in. And I would have thought that Simon probably would have moved fairly swiftly to kick her out. You wouldn't want someone like her ruining your social gathering. So I guess when she came in, she probably moved pretty quickly to Jesus. Otherwise, Simon would have interrupted. And then as Simon's there looking at her at Jesus' feet, I think he probably pauses a bit and goes, this is going to be quite an interesting story to tell to my mates at Pharisee Cafe later on. What's he going to do? You know, this woman with a terrible background is engaging with Jesus and touching him and kissing him, remember what her job was, and undoing her hair, which you would only ever undo in the presence of your husband. Is she trying to come on to Jesus? Really interesting. You see Jesus' wisdom here and having to discern. This could be something to really strongly reject, or... And I think her tears are probably the thing that make the difference, that make it clear that she's a broken lady. The surprising thing here is that Jesus goes on to then engage with Simon's private thoughts. Verse 39, all eyes are on the woman, and Simon's having these thoughts about her going, you know, if Jesus were a prophet, he would know who this woman is who's touching him. Jesus turns and engages with Simon's thoughts. And all of a sudden, Simon's comfort and feeling, you know, apart from the situation, he's suddenly drawn into it. Jesus gives the story in verse 41 to 43. He points out Simon's failings in verse 44 to 46. And suddenly, Simon's not feeling comfortable at all. Simon, who is a respectable Pharisee, who's used to people looking up to him. Simon, who, quite frankly, has done a very honourable thing in inviting Jesus, this unschooled teacher, to come and have dinner with him. I mean, Jesus should really be quite honoured by being invited to Simon the Pharisee's house. And yet Jesus is pointing out to him that this unschooled woman knows more than him, the school teacher. Simon, a Pharisee, who for the first 12 years of their life learned the first 12 books of the Bible, and then by 15, a good Pharisee would have learned the entire Bible. He would have memorized over 300 prophecies about the coming Messiah, and yet when the Messiah was there in front of him, he didn't recognize him. It's a shocking turnaround. The most religious person in the story is the furthest person from God. And this is where this parable really has a bit of a sting in the tail for us in the 21st century as well. And there's a question which I think arises from this passage, which is this. Who do you most want to be like in this story? Simon, the leader, religious leader, who's respected by everyone around him, or the broken woman who experiences the love and grace of Jesus? I don't know about you, but I sinfully actually want a bit of both. I quite like the bit about the position and the recognition amongst other people, but I quite like the grace and love of Jesus as well. I want to be like Simon in this story, but I want to change how it goes. I want Jesus to then apply this story and go, look, this woman's received grace, and then go, oh, Jesus, you are wise. I accept this. I will now use my power, my wealth, my status differently and be wiser in what I do. But I think I'm missing the whole point of this story. The point is that Christianity is not that we're all sorted, but that we're all broken. That we're broken people who get anxious. That we're broken people with judgmental thoughts and unhealed pasts. That we're broken people that hurt others with our words. But that Jesus is in the business of mending broken people. One of the reasons I think Mark writes in his account of Jesus' anointing by a sinful woman, that wherever the gospel is told, so will it be proclaimed what she has done, is because Christianity doesn't just, it's not that just that it begins by recognizing your brokenness, and then you get over that, and then you become like Simon the Pharisee, but it continues in this way as well. There's so many ways of baking this cookie. The top two commandments, to love the Lord your God with all you have, heart, soul, mind and strength, and to love your neighbour as yourself, is like it according to Jesus. They're linked. How you are before God reflects how you are before others. If you're truly broken before God, it will affect how you're broken before others. You may know the famous ancient Japanese pottery art that's quoted called kintsugi, where when a vase gets broken, they put it back together, glue it back together, but they highlight the cracks with gold. And it's so precious that actually they say it's worth more, to the extent that some collectors have been accused of deliberately breaking valuable pieces of pottery to put it back together with these traces of gold because they know it will sell for more. Well, that's like us in Christianity. We get broken and Jesus puts us back together and makes something more beautiful and more valuable from us. I think many times we fear openness because we're afraid of being hurt. We've had bad experiences in the past, and I get that. It's always easier to ask for a prayer request for some relative's health problem rather than ask for some battle that you're going through internally. It's hard, it's risky opening our hearts. C.S. Lewis says this in his book, The Four Loves. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your own selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell. It is risky being open, but it's risky not being open as well. At the men's breakfast a few weeks ago, I shared about a really silly example. How I was very embarrassed. Until about 5 years ago, I would never tell anyone that I would play computer games. It is such a trivial example, but I'd been made to feel so guilty from people in my family that this was not a pastime that one should ever do. And so I wouldn't share it, I would hide it up. And then at some point I was like, but really, is it all about hiding? Is that what we're trying to be? Or do we not want to be known? Do we not want to share? And so when I did start sharing with people were like, yeah, no, all right. As if, and it's not a big deal, but to me it was. And I was like, oh, wow, they're not reacting. Whereas before it'd always be like, quick, don't tell anyone. Oh, they're talking about computer games, play it cool. And I think so often some of the things we don't share are a bit like that. They're not a big deal. They might be to us, but when we share them, we realise, oh, it's okay. Now, that doesn't mean we should have no boundaries on our sharing. I'm not saying you should share the most intimate things of someone you've just met. You know, we need to be a bit like an onion with layers that you share at certain appropriate times. I've got something in my past that I don't think I've shared with any of you. Because it's very personal, it's often misunderstood. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't want to, I'm not prepared to be open. It's not an area that's locked away that I never share with anyone. It's something I'm perfectly willing to share when the time's right, but you test, don't you? The devil rebelled and ran away from heaven, if you like. He wanted to be on his own. He wanted to be independent. Whereas the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, they are together in open, full communion. And that's where we're going in heaven. That's the direction we're heading towards, full openness. It's only sin that ruins that in the time being. So let me just summarise this up. The question, the one thing I want you to remember from this passage would be that question. Who do you most want to be like in this passage? The well-respected Pharisee. Or the deeply broken and open woman who experiences the love and grace of Jesus. I'd like to close here, and I'd like to close with a song that celebrates best this passage. I had a good look through and struggled and thought I wasn't going to find anything. Then I came across number 26 in the white books. I will offer up my life in spirit and truth, pouring out the oil of love as my worship to you. And then it says, in surrender I'll give my every part. Lord, receive the sacrifice of a broken heart. We'll sing number 26.